I'm Amir Khan and you're listening to the Zed Medium podcast, a podcast that shares an honest account of the journeys of people from different walks of life. We talk to people and about them too. Think of us as a moving walkway at an airport. We take you where you need to be in life, only faster. Isn't it so interesting to snoop into the lives of people and get to know them inside out for over an hour? Like today, for example, we're looking at the life of someone who has been a writer, an editor, a creative director, and so much more. She's worked at companies like Time Out, National Geographic, Eros Now, Array, and Array as in the company Array, and until quite recently, MagicPen. And each experience taught her something very different. I mean, writers in general fascinate me quite a bit because of how unique a skill set working with words is. Karanjit Kaur's rise in the industry has been astronomical. And anyone aspiring to do something in this space must listen to this episode before making that decision. But before all of that, we have to ask her something that might just be the highlight of the entire episode. The answer to which determines her popularity with the listeners of the podcast. Let's start with this one, shall we? You're from Delhi, but you've spent a good amount of time in Bombay as well. Which is the better city according to you, Mumbai or Delhi?
It's very difficult to answer a question like that because I myself don't have an answer. Because every time I'm in Bombay, I long for Delhi because Delhi is home. Delhi is, you know, the winters are kind of unparalleled despite what they say about the pollution, etc. There's just such a lovely quality, harsh but lovely quality to the city, which I don't think any other city has. And currently I'm in Goa, but you know, when I was in Bombay, it was very easy for me to romanticize Delhi. And every time that I would go home and I would land in Delhi, I would, you know, take the cab home. And within an hour, I would be ready to go back to Bombay. And so it became very easy for me to, you know, whichever city I was in, to romanticize the other and to kind of chase the unattainable about a city. I don't know if I'm making much sense, but, you know, there is something, you know, to when you want a city and when you want to be in a city, there is something that you chase in it, whether it's the hustle, whether it's the romance, whether it's the beauty or whether it's the culture, whatever you want to call it. It was became very easy for me to romanticize the other city. So it's very difficult to say where my heart lies. It's a piece of it is in Bombay, a piece of it is in Delhi, and a big chunk of it is now in Goa, where I live.
This question would not have arisen if it was not your stint at the organization called Time Out. Right? Because you worked in Delhi and then Mumbai.
Yeah. Before Time Out, I used to be at this publication called Mail Today, and I was writing for Mail Today and India Today. And after about 3.5 years in these places, I was completely burnt out because it meant like long nights. It meant like, you know, lots of work. It was just madness, you know, working at a daily paper kind of teaches you a rigor, but it was madness. And 3.5 years in, and I was completely like, I had to sort of take a decision for my debates that we now have about mental health and, you know, this kind of vocabulary, I don't think we possessed at that time. What I did know was that I needed to put a pause because otherwise I would kind of, you know, crash and burn. So I did that and I took a backseat. I started working on freelance projects, which was great when you don't have rent to pay, when you don't have to think about where your next meal is going to come from. These are decisions that you can take. And so I was living in my mother's house in Delhi. So in those like 8 or 9 months that I spent freelancing, Time Out was a magazine I used to read religiously and I loved it to bits. And it was everything that I wanted to achieve in life. It was a magazine about art, about culture. These were fields that I was building my writing profile in even when I was at Mail Today. So while I was there, I was, you know, I started a culture supplement with the help of the team that I used to work with. Then kind of like pursuing it, you know, that's the field that I sort of ended up in. To that end, that's the kind of writing I wanted to continue doing. Yeah. And I think I applied a couple of times to the magazine, got rejected. So I said, okay, cool. We'll, you know, do something else in the meantime. But what I did do was a contract project with the publishing house that also published Time Out. So I was sort of in the vicinity for a while. It was a contract arm of Time Out, of Paprika Media, that used to publish Time Out. So I did that. And after about 6 to 7 months of, you know, working on that contract publishing project, I wrote a coffee table biography of Vikram Kothari, who's, you know, the late CEO of Rotomac Pens. And that meant like travel between Kanpur and Delhi. And so I did that for about 7 or 8 months, along with other freelance projects that I was working on. Okay. And finally, then I got, you know, recruited at Time Out because Raghu Karnad, the editor at Time Out, he was the one I was liaising with for the project as well. And we sort of figured that, you know, there was an opening there and I happened to fill it. Even though, like, you know, publishing has always been on the verge of shutting down, I think being at Time Out was like this happy sort of mix of all of these things. I had great colleagues. I learned so much from them. I learned so much about the city, which is why I think I really loved my stint at Time Out, because we used to have this section where we, you know, where we wrote about things about Delhi, you know. So somebody I know found an ostrich walking down Jamia Nagar, and then, you know, you decided to pursue a story about that. And it like led you to, you know, something completely different. So these were the kinds of stories that we had the liberty to pursue at Time Out, which kind of made it a really thrilling time.
What is your writing process like, and how has it changed from when you first started out to right now?
Wow, I haven't actually thought about this in a really long time, because also I haven't done a lot of very active writing in the last year or so. Prior to that, when I was the editor at Arre, then there was a lot of writing going on. But over the last year and a half, I've been at Magic Pin, which is, you know, I'm heading the content and community team, and I've just put in my papers. So I'm serving out my notice period here. So I would say when I was younger, there was, I think, my focus so caught up with trying to prove a point and trying to prove myself as a good writer. But the trouble is that when you're younger, you don't have the rigor of having done a lot of writing. You know what they say, like, you know, unless you write 10,000 pages or 10,000 words, I'm forgetting which one it is. Unless you do that, you can't really call yourself a writer. So this means that you have a lot of enthusiasm, but you don't have the capacity to translate whatever's going on in your mind into words and to do it in an efficient, economical, elegant manner. You don't have that elegance at that age. So a lot of my process used to be feeling like, you know, after having written a piece, putting my heart and soul and, you know, dictionary.com-ing the hell out of the piece, making sure that it looked pretty, and then having an editor completely demolish it. That, I think, was an integral part of the process. So I don't think I could really call myself a writer at that point, unless my writing had gone through an editor who would just, you know, sit with me. And my first boss, Saurish Bhattacharya at Mail Today, he was integral to the part of, you know, really kind of cutting you down to size, not intentionally, but like when you see your writing, you know, getting, there are like strokes and red marks all across your piece, you realize how humbling that experience is. I would say from that to becoming that person, becoming a Saurish for other people, that I think evolution took place over the years. And the more time you spend with words, the more time you spend writing, the more time you spend with other people's copy, the better you get at it. So there's no sort of shortcut to becoming a great writer or becoming an elegant writer overnight. I feel like you just can't do that.
You moved on from Time Out to National Geographic.
I did.
As a senior editor.
Yes.
Is there a story behind it, or was it plain and simple, you applied and you got the job?
I didn't apply to National Geographic. I got a call. I think they were, so this is interesting because I wasn't supposed to join National Geographic. I was supposed to join a new project that the publishing company was going to set up. And unfortunately, that magazine never ended up launching. It was supposed to be a women's magazine. And I was supposed to be the editor there. It was called, it's a French imprint that was supposed to come to India, and it was called Psychologies. It was a magazine for women, which was not about beauty and fashion. So let's just put it like that. It was supposed to be about the life of the mind and spirituality and a lot of other, I think, concerns. And it's actually a really good magazine. If you get your hands on it, and if you can read French, you should probably take that up. Yeah, so I was supposed to, you know, launch that magazine in India. Unfortunately, that project never ended up getting off the ground because of a variety of reasons. You know, publishers couldn't do it. There was some interaction going on between the French publishers and the Indian ones. And the person who hired me, Nilufer Venkatraman, who was my editor at National Geographic, the agreement that we had was that I would stay at National Geographic and Nat Geo Traveler until the magazine launched. I just happened to be there. And for a year and a half, I was, I think, a good year and a half almost, I think I was there. And it was a great time. I got to travel. But I realized that that's not something I wanted to continue doing. I don't know why. I kind of regret that decision now. But it was great while I was there. It was so nice to be able to travel, to see India, to see, I mean, I got to see parts of Chhattisgarh that I don't think I would have ever gotten access to if I weren't at Nat Geo. I traveled to Switzerland, and if I had continued to be there, it would have been a great life of traveling and writing and developing my own sort of field and my profile in travel writing.
You mentioned there was a lot of travel, and we actually had a question regarding that. What were some of the most interesting bits from your travels at Nat Geo?
Oh, wow. Okay. So let's see. I would say Chhattisgarh. It was a destination that doesn't come to your mind when you think of travel or tourism in India. And it's also very, very raw, but it's so beautiful. And it's so, you know, like when you go to Rajasthan, you know, you're going to a state where tourism is like an established industry. And it's, you know, you go to any regular hotel and you will probably have like a great experience, which is not to say that, you know, Chhattisgarh, I had crappy experiences, but, you know, the rawness of a part of your country that's still coming up, but yeah, which has these sort of amazing treasures. You know, I remember we went to this one place in Chhattisgarh called Sirpur, which is massive, you know, archaeological site. And it's still sort of every day treasures get dug up, and they're all like set up in this makeshift museum, which is, and these are unhoused treasures, you know, so from the 10th century or, you know, the 14th century, there are routinely these excavations, you know, will unearth these, some statue or of a dancing girl or something or the other. And they're just lying there, which yeah, is, which when you think about it, like really blows your mind. Aside from that, Chhattisgarh also has these really lovely natural features. So one of the places that we went to, and it's something I've never experienced before or since, was this sort of floating earth, you know. So there's a piece of land and you step on it and it's not solid. It kind of feels like you're standing on, you know, like a marshland. Yeah. And it's kind of floating up and down. So it's not, you're never steady when you're walking around it.
You're not sinking in also.
No, you're not sinking in because it's covered by this sort of solid, you know, layer. Yeah. But underneath is marshland, and you can walk on the whole thing. You won't like fall in. It's not wet. It's completely dry on top. Okay. But it just feels like, you know how it is, like those bouncy castles.
Yes.
If you try to walk on them, that's the sort of experience that you have. But it's not as light as walking on a bouncy castle. It's solid. It's one of those features that I've never seen anywhere in life. There was another, I think Amadob is the name of the place. There's a forest reserve. And we set out early in the morning on a safari. And I think within an hour, I must have seen like a bunch of creatures that, if you go to say Rajasthan or Madhya Pradesh, you will probably not, you know, encounter. And people go there especially to, you know, see these things. And we saw a sloth bear who's just like sitting there and eating like, you know, part of a branch or something in the middle of the road. Tons of bison, nilgai, so many kinds and varieties of deer, sambar, you know, those giant deers were, you know, they look so beautiful. All of these things. And then the safari kind of took you to this area where there was a lake, and the lake was, it's in the middle of the forest, and the lake is full of dead trees. It's unearthly. And if you were probably to encounter it at night, it would scare the hell out of you. But there are these like silver, stalks in the middle of this giant lake. And actually, somebody that we were traveling with told us that it looks exactly like the dead blay in Namibia. I don't know if you've seen pictures of it, but it's this dried up land with these stark trees, which are burnt black, but they're just there, you know, they're dead, but they're, and they're across, in the background, you can see the red sands of Namibia. And somebody said, I don't know why people go to Namibia to see the dead blay, because this is right here. And a few years later, it so happened that I did go to Namibia and we did go to dead blay. I'll be honest, like the dead blay is beautiful, but it was not more beautiful than being in this lovely little, sanctuary in Chhattisgarh. Yeah. So yeah, that's...
That was beautiful though. Like what you cannot imagine being in a place like Chhattisgarh, and you go and explore, you might just find things that you should first explore in India, and then
blows your mind really.
Yeah. Your time at National Geographic and Eros Now was quite limited as compared to your time at, I'm pronouncing it right, Array or Array?
Array. Array was the...
Made Array stick and Eros Now and Nat Geo not so much?
So Nat Geo, I think, nothing against the magazine, beautiful magazine, amazing people to work with. I felt like at that point that I wanted to do something different, which is when I joined Eros Now. The reason I didn't stick around much at Eros was because I think there was... First of all, there was like a lot of work was not really what it, I think I'd gone in with the wrong expectations. So what it turned out to be, it was not what I had in mind. Yeah. But the great thing about being at Eros was that I ended up making wonderful friends who are my friends even now. And, you know, just being around a set of crazy talented people feels, you know, which are laterally aligned to journalism. So they weren't like writers or journalists or editors in the way that we understand, in the way that I had previously encountered people, but they were script writers, they were producers, they were people who knew absolutely everything there is to know about Bollywood and about cinema and about B movies. And you know, at any day you could go into office and have a conversation about Tarkovsky or Wong Kar Wai and, you know, Shakti Kapoor in the same breath without, you know, taking a break. So the environment that Eros gave me was to just be in the presence of amazingly talented people. But the work itself didn't turn out to be what I expected. And then there were a lot of like changes at the high level, and I didn't want to sort of stick around and get, you know, involved with any of those people. No. So then I decided to, I remember walking out of a meeting and telling this colleague and friend of mine that I didn't want to do this anymore. And if there were any, you know, openings that she heard of, she could pass them on to me. Pretty much, I think the same evening, she told me that this new publication was due to launch, and if I was interested, I could sort of apply and see if it worked for me. Yeah. And I did, and that publication was Array. And, you know, I got hired after a series of interviews. And the reason I stuck around for such a long time at Array was because I think we were doing really good, exciting work. And I think I really stuck around for that rush and for that adrenaline surge that you felt pretty much every day when you had to respond to the news, whether it was via long form piece or a short form piece or an illustration or a meme or a video or a podcast or an audio recording, whatever you want to call it. There was, I think Array was very fertile ground for, again, a lot of really talented people. And just being there in that environment and leading that team kind of made me stick around for such a long time because, like I said, every day was a new challenge at Array. And I think me and the team that I was heading really believed in building something which was going to be worthwhile, which was something that we could be proud of. And to have a team which was equally invested in building this one thing, it was a really heady feeling being there. So that's why I was part of the founding team. So there was a lot of work to be done in the initial months. And then, you know, just building upon that and kind of analyzing every few months, what is it that you were doing? How could you do it better? Or what is it that you could stop doing? And what is it that you could start doing? All of these negotiations and, you know, push and pull forces, they were always at play at Array, and it made it a very exciting thing. And I mean, the people who ran it as well were also, they were very happy to let us take a lot of risks that a lot of other publications would not let you take. So right. Being there, like I said, it was a really heady feeling.
So the main question after that is, why quit?
Again, you know, lots of things, you know. I think by the time COVID had hit and things became quite different at Array, and the things became quite different at Array for me personally, and the goals that I wanted to pursue as well, I think I stopped seeing the vision that the founders had, and it didn't kind of align with what I wanted to do next. And I think I had reached a stage in my life and my career where other things were a little more important for me, having autonomy, having ownership over the work that I want to produce. Also, like, enabling your life in such a way that you are able to take a break, which is what I think I did with the Magic Pen, learning new things. All of these, I think, where I think every time I feel like my learning has stopped in a particular organization, I know that I need to move on. Which is how I've approached, I think, all my jobs. So, yeah, that's the reason.
What's the best piece of advice you've got when it comes to your writing? When it comes to writing in general?
I think it's a piece of advice that you don't need to just apply to writing, but I think any creative pursuit or any pursuit in general. You know, a friend of mine told me that Leonardo da Vinci or Michelangelo didn't just become those people overnight. You don't just get up one day and paint the Sistine Chapel. There is a lot of work that goes into it, and you know, you build bit by bit and brick by brick. So it's not as if you can sit and wait for inspiration to strike and then pursue that. You have to try like 15 different things to be able to get to that one Sistine Chapel. Don't prevent yourself from producing those 20 different pieces of garbage before you get to the Sistine Chapel. You need that. You need to produce 15 different things. You need to try different directions, you know, whether you're producing a podcast or whether you're pursuing, a piece. You need to try many different approaches, and you need to junk maybe 90% of those things. And then go after that one thread, but don't wait for inspiration to strike. Don't think that, you know, tomorrow I will get the inspiration that I need to paint the Sistine Chapel. That's not going to happen. Yeah. I think it's a very acutely wise piece of advice that I've got. And I think this friend of mine knew exactly what I was grappling with and knew what to tell me.
Coincidentally, the amount of inspiration one gets when they're about to go to sleep is paramount.
Yeah, no.
Anything in the morning.
Yeah. I suppose, you know, the challenge of the next day or the promise of the next day is very powerful.
Yeah.
Perfect. Has there been any piece or any write-up that failed miserably?
Difficult to answer, really, because again, it depends on how you define failure, right? There's no objective way of measuring failure. Failure could be that you've written an amazing piece and nobody read it. Failure can also be that 500 people read a piece that you absolutely hated writing. It really depends on how you view that. And I feel like I've had a bit of both in, yeah, difficult to say, but I can't really pinpoint one, which was...
Not read also,
I'll
but...
I'll tell you what hurt me. I worked on this podcast when I was at RA, and we produced it for Audible.
Yeah.
And to my mind, it's a great product. It's a lovely thing to have on my CV. I still feel all of the stories were really compelling. Unfortunately, it didn't do as well as we expected it to. And we were supposed to go into a second season. It didn't happen. It's called Air Dil Hai Complicated for anyone who wants to, you know, listen to it. It's the stories are great, but unfortunately, the kind of reception that it got didn't match up to what we'd expected and what we'd set out to do.
Right.
So, yeah, I would say that. But still, I don't define it as a failure because I still feel it's a
failure. We will not say
that. Yeah. But it didn't like do amazingly well.
Have you always wanted to be a writer, an editor, writer, right from the beginning?
Yeah, pretty much, I think. Now that I think about it, my mom would, you know, she pretty much knew, even before I knew, that I'd probably become a journalist or a writer and be a creative professional. I think she knew it a lot before I knew it. But yeah, I think ever since I've kind of figured out my... conscience and I've understood the ways of the world, I think I wanted to be a writer.
If you could go back in time and rectify one mistake, what would that one mistake be?
Absolutely nothing at all, I think. Maybe just, I don't know, maybe starting sooner on the path that I wanted to take, because I think I spent some time at a PR agency before I got into journalism. But even that is not really a mistake, I feel, because it kind of taught me, and it taught me what I was capable of and what I wasn't capable of, and what it kind of clarified things in my mind. But it's not really a mistake, but maybe I would have started a little sooner. I'm thinking of, you know, working on a project of my own. Don't ask me any questions about it because I have no idea what it is right now. But it'll most probably be a podcast and it'll most likely be set in Goa. Beyond that, even I have no clue what to do with it. But I'll figure that out in the coming days. I just felt like it was time for me to own something and own something creatively as well as financially or whatever. I mean, I don't know how to phrase that, but just have something to my name, which was...
But the question, we had another question and which was one of the final questions, what's next for you in this journey? So... Yeah, I know. You just answered it, but...
This personal project. I don't know what shape it will eventually take, but hopefully it will be a podcast.
And that's the end of the episode. If you enjoyed that, what's stopping you from sharing? We're on LinkedIn, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. Share and don't forget to tag us. For more updates, you can follow us at ZMedium on all the four platforms. We'll be back next Monday with more. Stay tuned and goodbye for now.